Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's open forum, but it's an internet open forum today because it's Edgar's wedding. And Edgar informed me at the break I will not be doing the electric slide. We have some sort of Mexican line dancing we'll be doing. So I gotta brush up on that. I'm going to have to watch some YouTubes and figure out what the steps are.
I wonder if the Macarena will be one of them.
Oh, are we going to do, will we be doing the Macarena? His wife is picking all that up. Yeah. Are we doing the? He got a very confused look on his face. Hmm. All right. Hey, Macarena. well, in any case, we're here now to do an internet open forum. Jimmy, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, author of a whole bunch of things, including A Daily Defense, which is now in podcast form. You can get it by going to where do you go for A Daily Defense? Where CatholicAnswersPodcast.com. Thanks, Edgar. And so I won't be giving out the phone number because all these questions have already come to us from the internet.
And before we get to the first new question, I wanted to add something to the question of Tony's that we answered at the end of last hour. Tony was asking in general terms about advice for people who, you know, need to deal with uncertainty. And I was giving the general advice that risk is just part of life. It's the way God designed things. And so we need to get to a position where we're okay with risk and we're okay with failure. And we realize God understands failure. He knows we have limited resources, and including cognitive ones. So if we're making decisions, we've only got limited information and we need to make a practical decision. We can't be paralyzed by fear. So the thing to do is just, you know, make the best decision you can and trust God, and he'll understand if you make the wrong one. So, you know, he's merciful. Don't worry about it. Don't be paralyzed. Tony also asked, he mentioned a specific thing that some people can get scrupulous about, which is small particles of the sacred host on your hands or elsewhere. And I had something I wanted to say about that because it's a little more specialized than general principles about dealing with risk. So, you know, one of the things that is quite well received in Catholic thought is that the real presence ceases when the consecrated elements become corrupt. So, and this is, you'll find this in every book on sacramental theology. You'll find it in official church documents that, for example, there was a document that the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith put out in the late 60s or early 70s on fragments of the host. And they made the point that the real presence remains as long as the appearance of bread remains. So if it looks like, if you would look at something and say, oh, that's a piece of unleavened bread, well, then it's got the real presence if it's previously been consecrated. But if you look at something and you wouldn't, what is that? It's not obvious it's a piece of bread anymore because it's so small, then it's not going to have the real presence. And this is something that, you know, I mean, that's in an official church teaching document. You know, that's from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. It was approved by the Pope. So this is part of church teaching that if the host has corrupted in such a way that it's such a small particle that it's no longer identifiable as bread, then it no longer has the real presence. And this is something you'll also, this is not some newfangled thing. You'll also find Aquinas saying exactly the same thing 800 years ago. He says, if you took a consecrated host and you pulverized it so it became a fine powder, it would no longer have the real presence because it's not, doesn't look like bread anymore. It looks like fine powder. And so that gets us to what some scrupulous people today worry about, which is little particles of wheat that may flake off of a host and get on your hand or get in the environment or things like that. And those are not going to have the real presence. They are not identifiable as bread. So they don't look like bread, and therefore they're not consecrated bread. They are something that has lost the real presence. And so people do not need to be scrupulous about this and should not be scrupulous about this because they'll go crazy
Yeah.
If they do, you need to recognize Jesus willed himself to be in the sacrament, but he willed himself to cease being present when the elements corrupt, such as by being just a tiny little particle. And so if there is a tiny little particle that doesn't even look like bread, it's not identifiable as bread, it looks like a little piece of dust or even a little, you know, white speck or something, that is not Jesus. Jesus did not will himself to be present in that. And consequently, you should not act as if Jesus is present in that. You should act normally, which is what Christ wants you to do. He wants you to live a normal life in a human mode, or in modo humano, as you could say in Latin. What his will for you is to not be scrupulous, to not be paralyzed by fear, to not be paralyzed by thought about tiny particles that came off the Eucharist, because he's not present in those. He wants you to live normally. And so you want to reverence him and worship him in the host, but not be paralyzed by thoughts of particles where he's not present.
Again, Tony, thank you very, very much for that question. This one comes from, I'm glad we started there, because I think this might be a tongue-in-cheek question, Albert's question. How is Elvis, and have you seen him lately?
Well, I always take questions straight. So in terms of how Elvis is, I haven't looked into the matter in depth, but my understanding is that the strong balance of evidence indicates that Elvis is dead and that he's buried at Graceland in Tennessee. Since I have not exhumed his body, I have not seen him lately. So I hope that helps.
Thanks, Albert. This one comes from Michael. If heaven...
He hasn't appeared to me in an apparition or anything, so I also haven't seen him that way.
I wonder how he would be dressed if he did appear to... Would it be the Vegas Elvis, or would it
any
be...
way he wants?
Yeah, I guess so. I guess
apparitions,
so.
Apparitions can change how they appear.
Thank you again, Albert. Michael asks this: if heaven is a perfect beatific vision of God, what purpose does the resurrection of the dead at the end of time serve? Why isn't heaven enough?
Well, it is enough for our souls, but our souls, the beatific vision is enough for our souls, but our souls are not all of us. We are not angels. Angels are created intellects that don't natively have physical bodies. Humans are created intellects that natively do have physical bodies. And so as long as we remain separate from our bodies, we are incomplete. You are not a complete human being. You may be a human soul, but you're not a complete human being unless you have a body. And so that's why God's going to put us back together the same way he put Jesus back together. The Christian fate is revealed in Jesus, and we're told we're going to be like Jesus. What happened to him is going to happen to us. He was resurrected in a glorified state, and so we're going to be resurrected in a glorified state as well. So we'll be glorified not only in our souls, via the beatific vision, but also in our bodies. And so we'll be complete glorified human beings, just like Jesus is a complete glorified man. If you think about it, you could say, well, why isn't the beatific vision enough for Jesus? I mean, why did he need to get resurrected? Well, for a bunch of reasons, but among them is he wasn't complete as long as he didn't have his human body. He took on a human nature, and that includes a human body. So as long as his human soul is separate from his human body, he's not complete. He's not a complete man. And so that's a defective state, and God doesn't leave defects in heaven, or in the eternal order. So he put Jesus back together, body and soul, in a glorified form, and he's going to put us back together, body and soul, in a glorified form.
Michael, thank you. That brings us to the break. It's Open Forum, Internet Open Forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest, right back with more of that.
Your questions, Catholic Answers, live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
This is Father Ramil Fajardo. Dear friends, if we understand the power of radio, then we can understand that the gospel can be made very real very convincing, powerful enough to send shockwaves throughout the whole country and indeed the whole world. Catholic radio was necessary in order that the gospel be sent throughout all the world, and most importantly, a convincing witness of Christ's presence here on earth.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live tomorrow on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. He's going to talk about black elk. And I really don't know anything about black elk, Jimmy. And it just makes me curious. Like, how do you come upon this mysterious figure to do a Mysterious World episode about?
Well, I study lots of different subjects, and so I come across lots of different things, and people make suggestions, and there's a specific reason why I was particularly interested in black elk, but I can't reveal that reason because it's what I'm going to reveal in part two.
Oh, okay. I see. Yeah.
Which deals with, like I said, this Friday, tomorrow, we're going to be talking about Black Elk's life as a medicine man and the various battles he participated in with U.S. federal forces and his mystical and paranormal experiences. But then there's a whole other side to his life that some historians have tried to suppress and hide from the public. And it's that hidden side that involves an even more interesting mystery that we're going to talk about next Friday.
Yeah, that's the part grabbed me in your description. I was like, what?
Yeah. But spoilers, sweetie, I'm not to quote River Song. I'm not going there right now.
River Song, is that's from Firefly?
Doctor Who.
Oh, from Doctor Who. Okay, yeah. All right. Have you ever seen Firefly?
Of course.
Oh, River Tam. Is it
the River Tam? Yes.
I don't know why that's even in my brain, man. That's why I can't remember stuff, because I have Firefly characters in my brain. I almost gave out the number, but I'm not giving out the number because it's an internet open forum, and the internet has asked Jimmy.
Fortunately, the Firefly characters only come out after sunset during the summer.
Yes, yeah, that's right. Well, see, that's why I'm remembering them now. Mark asked this. Am I on Mark? Yes. I know that God can hear our thoughts and knows what we're thinking. I have heard that Satan and the demons cannot. What about the saints and angels? If they cannot hear our thoughts, what about mental prayer?
Okay, so the church doesn't have a teaching on this. This is all matters of opinion. Now, in terms of the classical opinion that you hear, and this would be from people like Aquinas and so forth, they would say, yeah, Satan can't hear your thoughts. And they would say the same thing about saints and angels. They can't hear your thoughts either. The standard view for then how the saints and angels get to know about your thoughts, you a living person, is that God tells them. So when you pray to a saint or an angel, or especially at least a saint, even an angel in Aquinas's view, God gets that information because he's omniscient. And then he gives that information to the saint or the angel because it's relevant to them, so they can take action on your prayer, such as by praying for you. And so God functions on this kind of like a postmaster or an internet hub in routing information to these other locations. That's Aquinas's view. Now, I should note that Aquinas and people of this ilk will say, even though demons can't directly read your thoughts, they can estimate what you're thinking because they're smarter than we are. And so just like we can read body language, you know, if I see someone and they've got a really happy expression on their face, I can infer that in their thoughts they are happy. Also, if I see someone who is aiming a rifle at a deer in the woods, I can infer that that person is thinking about shooting the deer. So I can infer things even as a human based on watching a person's external behavior, watching what their body is doing. And so Aquinas and people of his ilk would say that demons can do that even better. So by reading the externals of a human, things that are outside of their mind, by looking at their body, they can estimate what a person is thinking. They also have another tool, which is they can drop temptations into your head and see how you react. And so they could estimate things based on that as well. Today, the given our present knowledge of the of neurology and how our thoughts are largely mirrored in the activation states of the neurons in our brain, well, that adds a whole new dimension to how angels and demons might be able to determine our thoughts based on looking at our bodies. If they're looking at our neurons and seeing which ones of them are activated, then they could get a very precise understanding of what we're thinking. In fact, we have the ability to do this now to a limited extent. There have been brain imaging technologies developed that allow us to tell what visual image a person has in their mind or an animal based on the activation states in their brain. For example, there were news stories a few months ago about a software program that had been developed to look at the visual cortices of mice, and you could tell which movie they were watching based on watching the activation states in their brain. And you could reconstruct the motion video that they were watching. And so if angels and demons are looking at our neurons, they could get a very accurate representation of what we're thinking. Having said all that, that's the view that they don't know our thoughts. And you might wonder then, well, why would someone say this? You know, why would someone say they can't read our thoughts, even if they can estimate them really well? Well, Aquinas has, if you look in the Summa Theologia where he talks about this, he cites a particular verse, which is Jeremiah 17:9. And in Jeremiah 17:9, it says, "The heart is perverse above all things and unsearchable. Who can know it?" And the implication is nobody can know it. You know, no human can search the heart and tell what it's doing. But then the text says, "I am the Lord who searches the heart." So this text effectively says, well, nobody really knows the heart except God. Okay, fine. That's true among humans. No humans totally penetrate your heart.
Right.
But that doesn't say anything about angels. Angels are not mentioned in this text. They're not under discussion. All this text says is, all you can infer from this with confidence is no human can fully know the heart. It doesn't, because obviously we partially know each other's hearts. You know, we learn that through various means. But what we don't have is full, unfettered access to someone's heart. That's something God has. But that doesn't tell us what angels have or what saints in heaven have. And so this is, I don't think, remotely sufficient proof for the idea that demons wouldn't have what you could call passive telepathy, which would be the ability to, maybe it would be better called intrusive telepathy, where you could read someone's mind. I don't think this is remotely an adequate text for that, because that's not what Jeremiah is going on about. He's not telling us about angels here. He's contrasting God and man, and angels aren't part of Jeremiah's discussion. So I think it's a mistake to try to use this passage to infer anything about angelic cognition. And when we come to telepathy, well, that's the only way angels could talk in a native form, because mm-hmm. they don't have bodies. So their communication is going to be mind to mind. And actually, they didn't have the term telepathy in the 13th century when Aquinas wrote. It was coined in the 19th century. But Aquinas basically acknowledges that angels are going to be telepathic. He talks about how greater angels and lower angels can reveal their minds to each other. And so he's got a form of telepathy that the angels are using, but they're not reading each other's minds. Instead, this is what you could call it active telepathy or broadcast telepathy. I need to think more about the best terms to use for it. But basically, the angels have the equivalent of a telepathic voice. And so just like with humans, if I say, Cy Kellett, here's this piece of information you should know, and I use my voice to communicate that to you, then you learn that piece of information. And Aquinas thinks that angels have the same kind of thing, only it's telepathic. They have a sort of telepathic voice that they can broadcast information to each other with. But what they can't do is reach into somebody and pull out information that that person isn't trying to share with them, in the case of an angel. In the case of a human, they can guess what the human is thinking based on the bodily states and reactions of the human, but they can't directly reach into the mind and pull the information. However, why not? You know, I can't rule that out as a possibility.
Yeah.
We have evidence among humans. Now, one of the things that medievals would do with angels, because they're created intellects, is they'd use them as models for human cognition. So if we can figure out an angel is able to do something, then a human intellect should be able to do the same thing in principle, maybe not at the same degree, but the same kind of thing in some way. So you can use angels as models for human intellects, but you can also do the reverse. You can use human intellects as models for angelic intellects. And with human intellects, at least various parapsychologists would say, we've got evidence for telepathy. You look at twins, and twins seem to display telepathy on some cases. You look at spouses, they seem to display telepathy on some cases. Now, whether you believe those studies or not is up to you. You can make your own decision. But if you think that we have evidence of telepathy in humans, where one twin can read another's mind without the first twin trying to broadcast that information, then presumably the same thing would be true of angelic intellects. So I think it's an interesting area to think about. You know, how does all this work with saints and angels and telepathy and prayer? One thing I would say, because some people get worried, you know, what if demons can read my thoughts? Well, don't worry about it. Because number one, because they can probably guess what you're thinking anyway by looking at your bodily reactions, including the activation of the neurons in your brain. And number two, the more important reason, God's going to protect you. So yeah, just love and trust God, and don't worry about what angels or Satan or other spiritual beings can do in regard to reading your mind. You're in God's hands. He's going to protect you, and nothing useful is going to be served by worrying about these other possibilities. They're interesting to think about, but you shouldn't worry about them.
Thank you, Mark, for the question. Thanks very, very much. It's Internet Open Forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and this question comes from Jenna. Is the idea that all men might be saved, that is, go to heaven, a heresy?
Okay, so I may need to cover some of this on the other side of the break because we're coming up to that. But
okay,
the basic answer is going to be no. And the reason I say that is because heresy means something very specific. A heresy is a post-baptismal refusal to believe a dogma of the church. And a dogma is also something very particular. A dogma is a teaching that the church has infallibly defined to be divinely revealed. It's not sufficient that it be divinely revealed. The church has to have infallibly defined that it is divinely revealed. And so a heresy will be the post-baptismal refusal to believe a truth that the church has infallibly defined to be divinely revealed. So in order for saying all men, the idea that all men are saved is a heresy, you're going to have to show where the church has infallibly defined that it is divinely revealed that not all men are saved. And that is something burden of proof is on you, because the Code of Canon Law, this is Canon 749, Section 3, says no teaching is to be understood as infallible unless the contrary is manifestly true. So you're going to need it to be manifestly true, meaning really clearly true, that the church has infallibly defined that it is divinely revealed that not all men are saved. Now, you do have various magisterial documents saying not everybody is saved. but that's just a magisterial document. That makes it a church teaching. That doesn't make it an infallible definition that this has been divinely revealed. And so consequently, you know, I know the history of the literature in this area pretty well, and I can tell you there aren't any such infallible definitions that it is divinely revealed that that there are human beings in hell. That's church teaching, but that's not an infallible definition that this has been divinely revealed. So it's not a dogma, and therefore it would not be a heresy to claim the contrary. Now, there's a little bit more to say about that, but we can cover that on the other side of the break.
All right, Jenna, thanks for the question. We'll get to covering that on the other side of this break. Jimmy Akin's our guest. It's Internet Open Forum. Lots more questions to come in addition to finishing up this one from Jenna right after this on Catholic Answers Live. This year, the Catholic Answers Conference turns its attention to the question of God in an age of unbelief. Join us September 21st through 24th in San Diego for I Believe in God, featuring very special guest Scott Hahn and an all-star lineup of speakers. Spend four fun days with your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. Seats are still available, but going fast. Use promo code EARLY to save $50 and register today at CatholicAnswersConference.com.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret, we've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's an Internet Open Forum, and there's a little more to be said, Jimmy said, about Jenna's question, which was, is the idea that all men might be saved a heresy? Jimmy?
Yeah, so there are recent church documents that, there are various church documents, some of which are infallible. That's not the same as saying they're dogmas, because a dogma is more than just an infallible teaching. It's something that the church has infallibly defined to be divinely revealed, not just to be true. There are some documents that say, well, like, if you did this, then you would go to hell. If you, like, die in a state of mortal sin, then you're going to go to hell. But the question is, do we have an infallible teaching that it is divinely revealed that some people do die in mortal sin and go to hell? And the answer is no. We have church teaching, including in some recent documents, that would say that happens. In Pope Benedict's encyclical Spes Salvi on Christian Hope, he has a passage where he discusses hell, and he says that there seem to be cases where this happens. You know, he alludes to some in recent history. I'm not sure who he's thinking of, but Adolf Hitler would be on my list for people he might be thinking of. So you can say we've got some church teaching that points in this direction, but it's not a dogma. It's not even infallible. And it's been kind of tentative recently on this. You had, during the reigns of John Paul II and the reign of Benedict XVI, you had a lot of tentativeness about this, and you even had speculation to the contrary. Hansers von Balthasar, for example, wrote a book defending the idea not that we might assert that all men are saved, but that we might hope that all men are saved. And he, that was not regarded as a problem in that John Paul II later appointed him a cardinal.
Mm-hmm.
And precisely because, not because he was the bishop of some major city, but because of his theological contributions. He's one of the theological cardinals. And so the idea that there are definitely people in hell is part of church teaching on my reckoning, but it seems to be a low order of church teaching at present, and the magisterium has not had a problem with people speculating that God might make a way for all people to die in a state of grace. So that's what I have to say about that. But what I can say definitely is this isn't a heresy. You can argue it's against church teaching. You can argue it's false. You can argue it's a bad idea, but it's not a heresy.
Jenna, thank you very, very much for that question. Paul asks this: what is the significance of Jesus, age 12, when he stayed behind in the temple?
So I don't think there is a particular significance to it. I think, people will sometimes, notice that, the number 12 is kind of special in the Bible. We've got 12 tribes and we've got 12 apostles, and Jairus's daughter is 12 years old, and, things like that. And they kind of wonder, is there like a numerological thing going on here in all these cases? And in some cases, I think, yes. I think the number of the 12 apostles is directly based on the 12 tribes of Israel. I think Jesus did that consciously to signify that he's making the new Israel. And so these are like the apostles are the new patriarchs of his new Israel, his new community. But in other cases, like Jairus's daughter being 12, I think she just happened to be 12 at the time. I don't think there's any magical numerological significance beyond that. And I think the same thing is true of Jesus when he's found at the temple. Certainly in the literal sense of the text, Luke doesn't say anything that would attribute special significance to this number. And you could speculate, maybe in the spiritual sense of the text, there's something there, but you can speculate anything in the spiritual sense of the text. It's very hard to prove it, though. And so I don't see any special significance here. I think that, and this is not the kind of significance that I think Paul's asking about, but I think that a dimension of what's going on here is Jesus is old enough to spend time away from his parents. This wouldn't have happened if he was 4. Yeah. They would have kept more close eye on him. And so he, at age 12, because they didn't have the obsessive children must never be left alone ethic that has come up in the last, 10 or 20 years in our culture.
Right.
When I was growing up, kids could entertain themselves. They could go off in the woods. They could do stuff. They could stay at home. You needed a babysitter when they were younger, but by the time they're getting to be 12, you don't necessarily need that. You can go away for a little while and they can take care of themselves and they can run around the neighborhood and play with their friends or go explore. And so, they didn't have this obsessive, ridiculous fear that we do that children must never be left alone. And so by the time Jesus was 12, his parents let him have liberty. And they assumed that he was with the party when they started heading back to Nazareth, but he wasn't. And so they had to come back and find him. But I think that a element of the significance of Jesus's age is, well, by this age, they were giving him freedom to spend some time alone away from them and look after himself.
Thank you. Very, very good question. Thanks very much. That was Paul. Thank you, Paul, for that question. This one comes from Jameson. Can you give a take on the Bible stance versus flat or round earth, as well as space and dimensions? Oddly enough, I've been seeing these debates lately. Yeah. Thanks, James.
Yeah. So there are various passages in the Bible that seem to reflect particular ways of conceptualizing the earth, and they don't all agree. You will have some passages that will say that the earth, that speak of the earth as if it has four corners and rests on pillars. So it'd be like a kind of a table. You know, you've got these pillars like the legs of a table, put a four-cornered flat surface over those, and the world would look like a table. But you have other passages that say God hung the world on nothing, implying it doesn't have a foundation. So these are just what that shows us is there's not a single way in the Bible of envisioning the earth. These are poetic expressions based on the common culture of the day, but they are not divine assertions that we must consider the world under one of these images rather than the others. So this gets us to the difference between what a text is asserting and what it's assuming. According to the Second Vatican Council document, Dei Verbum, the Holy Spirit asserts whatever the sacred authors assert in the proper sense of assert, meaning the thing they're claiming is true. And so because of that, since the Holy Spirit's always accurate, then whatever the sacred authors assert is going to be accurate. But that doesn't mean that everything the sacred author assumes is going to be accurate. St. Paul, for example, teaches that at the resurrection of Jesus, the dead will be raised and they'll be caught up with living Christians to be with Jesus. Okay, so that's what Paul's asserting. But in the course of asserting that, he assumes he's still going to be alive when that happens. He says, we who are alive and remain will be caught up with the newly raised dead. So he was assuming that he was going to be alive at the second coming, but God later revealed to him that wasn't the case. By the time he writes 2 Timothy in AD 66, he knows he's going to be martyred before that happens. He's talking about, I've finished the race. I'm about to die. I'm being poured out like a drink offering. So he knows he's not going to be alive at the second coming. So that shows us that what Paul was assuming was not necessarily accurate, because he assumed he would be alive at the second coming. But what he asserted, which was that at the second coming, the dead will be raised together with the living, that is true. So when we look at these various passages in the Old Testament, they're not trying to teach us about the shape of the world. They're trying to teach us other stuff, like God made the world, and the world's not just going to be destroyed, it's stable, and things like that. And those things are all true, but they may picture it in, sometimes they may picture it in terms of, oh, it's like a table, or it's like a plant basket that you hang up, only it's not hanging on anything. So those assumed things that we can talk about it in these other ways are fine, but we shouldn't assume that the Bible is asserting them, because it's not. It's just using these images to make other points. There also is a shift over the course of the biblical period. There were some early Hebrews who tended to assume that the world was flat, and they had different elaborations of exactly how that would work. Some of them supposed there was that it was floating on water, kind of like a lily pad. Others didn't. We also mentioned the table model and the basket model. By a few centuries before the time of Christ, the Greeks had worked out that we're actually living on a sphere. And that was the common view, certainly among the educated, by the first century in the Greco-Roman world, which included Israel. So you had Jewish figures who recognized, yeah, Greeks have good arguments that we're living on a sphere. And so probably, even though the New Testament doesn't really address this question, various New Testament authors like Paul, who were very well educated, were probably sphere earthers rather than flat earthers. I did an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World on the flat earth theory. It's episode 68. So you can hear my discussion of all the different Bible passages as well as arguments for and against flat earth by going to mysterious.fm/68. I also did a more recent episode. This is episode 245 called Starts with a Bang. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Actually, that's not the one I want. It's How We Found. It's called How We Found the Universe. And I don't have the episode number for it, but I talk about the different models for the universe that have been proposed over the years, including the one that was common early in Christian history, which was basically a variation on the Greek understanding of the Earth is at the center of the cosmos and it's a sphere. And around the sphere, there are a set of concentric shells that are transparent that the planets orbit on. And as the spheres rotate around the Earth, and then beyond the planet Saturn's orbit, there is the sphere of the fixed stars. And so they thought the universe, most people thought the universe at the time was a little bit bigger than the orbit of Saturn. And I talk about how over time various elements of that fell away. And we developed the modern understanding of the universe, which is basically we're in a sea of galaxies. And so check out episode 68 on the Flat Earth Theory, as well as How We Found the Universe and Starts with a Bang, which talks about how we found the Big Bang Theory.
Jameson, thanks very much for the question. We'll take a quick break, right back with more Internet Open Forum for Jimmy Akin.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
Hi, I'm Debbie Giorgiani. Adam Bly and I invite you to join us as we tackle the spirit world on EWTN Radio. Adam has assisted at thousands of solemn exorcisms and resolutions of hauntings. He also reaches out to educate people on the paranormal and the occult in our culture. Join us Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern for the spirit world on EWTN Radio.
Catholic Answers Live. So Saturn is the farthest object in the solar system that you can see with the naked eye. Is that what?
Correct?
Oh, I see.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Let's see. It's Internet Open Forum, and Jimmy Akin is our guest. The next one comes from Sean. In John chapter 5, verse 18, it says the scholars wanted to kill Jesus not only because he was breaking the Sabbath, but because he made himself equal with God. This seems like an instance where the author asserts Jesus made himself equal to God, but does it by the same token mean Jesus was breaking the Sabbath? If we're to say the first accusation that he was breaking the Sabbath was just their mistaken impression, would that not also apply to the second accusation that he made himself equal to God? Oh, funny logic. Yeah, interesting, Steve.
Okay, so in order to answer this question, we need to look at the text, because there are texts where Jesus defends him healing on the Sabbath as not being a violation of the Sabbath. Like, for example, he will say things like, "Tell me, what do you think? Is it lawful to kill or to heal on the Sabbath?" And it's like, well, if that's the choice, it would be lawful to heal. And so he says, therefore, let's heal this guy. But that's not what he does in this text. He doesn't mount an argument, at least not an explicit argument, that what he's doing is actually lawful. Instead, if you look at the overall passage in John 5, it says, the man, this is the one who Jesus has healed, the man went and reported to the Jews that Jesus was the one who made him well. And on account of this, the Jews began to persecute Jesus because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. But he answered them. So this is Jesus' response to the charge, hey, you shouldn't be doing this on the Sabbath. He says, my Father is working until now, and I am working. Okay. He didn't deny working on the Sabbath. He just used the word work Mm-hmm. Now, he's got an implicit argument that it's okay for him to do this because he's the son of the Father, and the Father maintains the universe in existence and keeps it running. So the Father is working on the Sabbath, and he's the son of the Father, so it's okay for him to do it. But, I mean, that seems to be what he's implying. But he doesn't deny working on the Sabbath. And he doesn't say this isn't the kind of work that the Sabbath commandment involves. He doesn't do that. So the Jewish people have a plausible, I mean, the Judean people, that seems to be how John may be using the term Jew in this case. They seem to have an argument. It's like, okay, he just confessed. He's breaking the Sabbath. He's working on the Sabbath. And so I don't know that, I mean, Jesus clearly thinks it's okay for him to do that, but he doesn't seem in this passage to be denying that that's breaking the Sabbath. So at least if we are taking this text on its own terms, you could say in the way the Jewish people are conceptualizing this and the way John may be conceptualizing it is Jesus is breaking the Sabbath. He's not doing what's commonly understood you're supposed to do on the Sabbath. He is breaking the Sabbath, and it's okay for him to break the Sabbath. And that's why they're persecuting him, because he is breaking the Sabbath, and he is calling himself equal to God. And so both of those things are bad in their view, when really they're both fine in the Christian view. It's fine to break the Sabbath, and it's fine to regard Jesus as equal to God. So so the two items may not be in contention about what Jesus was doing here. The question is, how do we evaluate those two items? Are they good things or bad things? Now, you can conceptualize breaking the Sabbath other ways, like Jesus does in other passages, and says, hey, it's going to be lawful to do this because you can heal on the Sabbath. And so that doesn't actually break it. But in this passage, it seems he is assuming that he is working on the Sabbath, and John does not censure the Jesus's critics for assessing that he's breaking the Sabbath. He just thinks it's okay for Jesus to do this.
What a precise reading, Stephen. You really spotted that. So thank you very, very much for that question. I'm going to go to this question from George. I have learned from one of my professors that the First Vatican Council ended rather abruptly due to the eruption of the Franco-Prussian War. How did the Franco-Prussian War affect Vatican I ending early?
Okay, so your professor's correct. They did have, the initial discussions at the First Vatican Council. This is, you know, like 1870. And they published two documents. One of them was called De Filius and the other Pastor Eternus. They dealt with questions of revelation and the miracles in the faith. That's the first document. And then also the infallibility of the Pope and authority of the Pope, which is the second document. Then they broke for summer, as you do in Europe. And they were going to come back later in the year and have another discussion. And they were going to talk, for example, about writing a third document on the nature of the church, which they didn't get to do. And the reason is because France and Prussia went to war, giving us the Franco-Prussian War. And in the course of that, at one point, the French Emperor Napoleon III was captured. But basically, you had some French troops that had been stationed in Rome and the Papal States. And the reason they were there is in part because there was a move in Italy at the time to unify Italy and make it a united kingdom under a secular monarch. I want to say King Victor Emmanuel, would be the first king of the United Italy. And so you had these Italian revolutionaries that were trying to take over territory in Italy, and they were and French troops were there guarding Rome to prevent them from seizing Rome. Well, with the Franco-Prussian War and the capture of Napoleon III and other stuff going on, the French pulled out their troops. It's like, we need these guys elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So they pulled out the French troops, and that meant that the Italian revolutionaries could take over Rome, which they then did. You might look up, for example, Giuseppe Garibaldi. He was one of the leaders of the Italian unification movement. And so they take over Rome. And after that, Pope Pius IX suspends the council, and he considers himself a prisoner in the Vatican for the rest of his pontificate. Now, he wasn't really literally a prisoner. They were not detaining him there. He was not arrested. He was not imprisoned. But he regarded himself as a prisoner in the Vatican, and basically stayed there for the rest of his reign. Later popes, you know, who didn't have this as quite the searing wound that it was to Pius IX, you know, were able to establish a better relationship with the new Kingdom of Italy. And eventually, as we approach the Second Vatican Council, Pope John the 23rd formally closed the First Vatican Council. So even though it only met like around 1870, it continued on paper until in a suspended form until around 1960. And then John the 23rd formally closed it, and he opened the Second Vatican Council, and it finally did get to write that document on the church that Vatican I had meant to get around to but didn't. And that's the document Lumen Gentium, the dogmatic constitution on the church.
Thanks, George. Thanks for that question. Celine has a question. She wants to know, many choir members and others think that black coffee, plain tea, diet drinks, etc. are okay to have during Mass to aid them while singing and then receive communion. I don't know how to explain that only water is allowed if they start to argue about their drinks having no calories or sweeteners.
Yeah, so food is not about calories. Food is about more than just calories. It's about other things as well, including the gustatory experience of eating food and experiencing the flavors and things like that. And so your friends are mistaken that black coffee and plain tea and diet drinks do not break the fast. The place you want to go to document that for them is the Code of Canon Law, and specifically you want to go to Canon 919, so 919, Section 1 of the canon, and this is what it says. A person who is to receive the Most Holy Eucharist is to abstain for at least 1 hour before Holy Communion from any food and drink except for only water and medicine. Okay, so water is the only liquid exception here, or liquid medicines would also be an exception. But of beverages, water is the only exception. So if you're having flavored water like diet drinks, tea, or coffee, even if it has no calories, it's not the same experience as drinking water. And you have more of an experience with flavor and things like that. So it's not about the calories, it's about the experience. And according to Canon 919, Section 1, of beverages, water is the only exception. So that's where you want to go to document that for your friends. Now, I'm not sure why they would think that having these drinks would help them sing. I don't know if it's the caffeine that these have or what they're thinking. They could always take a caffeine tablet and water. That would be okay, I would think, because a caffeine tablet is not considered food. If anything, it would go in the category of medicine, because you're taking it to repair a situation and help keep yourself awake and so forth. But people, when they look at a little tablet like a caffeine tablet, they don't think, oh, that's food. They look at a little tablet and think, oh, that's medicine or something. Or what they can do is just have their coffee and tea 15 minutes before Mass. Because if Mass goes for an hour, you're not going to be receiving communion until, let's say Mass starts at 8 a.m. Well, you're not going to be receiving communion till 8:45, so just have your coffee before 7:45 and you'll be fine.
Seems like an easy solution. Thanks very much for the question. Thanks to everybody who shared their questions with us via the internet. If you want to send more, send them to radio@catholic.com, or if you have some way of contacting Jimmy directly, if there's lots of people in contact with Jimmy, you can do that. But we'll get it to him if you send it to us at radio@catholic.com. Don't forget Black Elk tomorrow morning on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World at mysterious.fm. Jimmy, thank you very much. Really enjoyed those 2 hours.
My pleasure. Me too.
All right. That does it for us. We'll see you next time. God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.